Okay, last night's discussion started off with a subject that is called Me'or Sheva Torah. And Me'or Sheva Torah is a idea that comes from the Yerushalami, which means the Jerusalem Talmud. And there's also a couple of ideas and a couple of verses that relate to it. But this Me'or Sheva Torah basically has this dedicated purpose where what happens with this aspect of the Torah is it has this aspect of return. So the thing you should know is that in the prophets, which you probably have read in the recent, those who are a part of my Wednesday night class that's going now for the college class on Romans 8, which is only a couple more lessons, but nevertheless, you should know that the prophet Jeremiah, Yirmiyahu, says that what God is going to do is that he's going to give us what is called Torat Bekirbam, and that means to put his Torah inside of us. And so now once you get the Torah inside of you, and then you use this Me'or Sheva Torah, what happens is Me'or Sheva Torah literally means the light, the luminary light of the Torah. Okay, so when the light of the Torah begins to shine, then there are multitudes of things that begin to happen in your spiritual person, but it basically makes a mechanism so that once you have a little bit of Torah inside of you, then you're trapped. You're stuck like rats. You can't get out. You have to keep going with the Torah because once the Torah is implanted within you, it never leaves. And then there is a idea we discussed a little bit. This is not the whole conversation for this evening, but this idea of Seor. And Seor, most of us understand, but we just don't understand it in this frame. So if I say leaven, all of us here pretty well know, and the first thing that clicks in your head is you start to think about Passover. And so when you think about Passover, you know the first thing you're going to do is find all the leaven in your house, get the leaven out, and et cetera, et cetera. Then we go through, you know, the 7 days of unleavened bread, 8 days basically, but nevertheless. Then, you know, you get the leaven out. Now, when you say Seor, in regards to the Torat Bekirbam, then what means is that the Torah inside of you begins to inflate as if it had an agent like yeast to make it grow inside. So, of course, everybody knows what the agent is, right? It's the Ruach HaKodesh. It's the Holy Spirit. And then once the Holy Spirit comes in, then I call it this quantum entanglement. Okay, what happens is you start to have all of the aspects of your spirituality, they start to work together, and when one's not working, the other one's working. When you're not thinking about it, they're all working. And the whole point is that it actually takes your spiritual person and keeps drawing it upwards. And as it draws it upwards, it continues to expand and continues to expand spiritually. And so this process is back to this idea of the fact that the Torah is a luminary. Now, when you read in Genesis, 1 and 14 and the following verses, and it says that God made two me'orot. Okay, so you can hear me'or and me'orot as the plural in that particular system. And so the Me'orot are the sun and the moon, okay? And really, however you want to define it, you can say it however you want. I'm not into the semantics of the whole situation, but the moon is only reflecting the light of the sun. So in one sense, it doesn't radiate light of its own source. It radiates the light of the sun. But the Torah is not physical, okay? So the sun is a physical thing that radiates or illuminates life in general, okay? But the Torah is not natural. Therefore, the illumination that comes from the Torah is raw spirituality, okay? And there's one thing that you should also know. I don't know if I mentioned this last night or, you know, in the past few sessions or not. But once the Torah begins that process of illumination, we have this radiant light that begins to shine. Now, the radiant light that comes down is twofold. It's number one called the Or HaGanuz. And when you talk about the Or HaGanuz, you're talking about what we call the primordial light. Now, this is very hard to difficult to explain and hard to understand because most people can't stop and differentiate between, you know, the comma in the sentence. And it says, and God said, let there be light, and there was light, okay? So when most people read this, when they read it, they say, okay, God created light, and there was light, and then the light continued to be. But according to the sages, and according to all of the material, the light was, it initiated, and then it stopped being visible. And there was light in the past tense. So you put that part of the sentence in the past tense. There was light, and now it's gone, okay? And then Psalms 97:11, it says that the light is hidden or sown for the righteous. And so when it's sown for the righteous, that means it's hidden away for the righteous. Now, the two things that happen when you start to take in this entanglement, literally, of spirituality that is within us, it's kind of like you can't get away. You're stuck. Even though you think you're going to get away, you can't get away because it's like you're captured by the Torah. And for us, we're all right now jumping up and down and saying, hooray, you can't get away. And so it's a good thing. And for me, I say it's a good thing. You know, God has me wrapped up and I can't get away. And he just keeps pouring stuff in my head. And so that is what it is. And I guess I just have to live with it. You know what I mean? Even though it's a hard thing to have to do, right? But somebody's got to do it. So that's how it goes. Okay, so my point here then is that once you bring in the idea of the Or HaGanuz, the sages say, oops, put the brake on, because what this means is that everything is temporal, okay? And it has to do with time. Therefore, the time that it talks about, and of course, as we all know well, is the festivals, okay? So the festivals are seven particular festivals, and each one of them, we would say that they are a festival of some sort of spiritual life, okay? Or I should say spiritual light. And that light, when it comes, again, the interesting thing that most of us don't really stop to think about is that when the light is flowing, once it started flowing, it never stops. So you can say, wait, I got enough. I don't want any more today. I need a pause. I need a break or whatever. God says, sorry about your luck. You're going to get more anyway. Okay. And really, when it's all said and done, you know, that's good for all of us. Or at least I know it is for me. And so that way I know there's something up there besides just empty air inside of that cavity, right? But when we then come back to this word, Me'or Sheva Torah, then, you know, for me, the first thing I want to do is, okay, I want to break this down. I want to understand these words. I want to know what each word means so that I can understand what I'm saying. I just don't want to be saying some word. Sounds pretty good, but I don't really know what it means. So Me'or means a luminary, okay? So we got that part already. And so it is a luminary of itself. It does not need any other light. It's woven light from the very beginning of creation. Literally not physical creation, but the beginning of spiritual creation, if you want to say it like that. Okay, so when we take into account all the realms that are above us, all the spiritual realms, the light actually comes down from above all those realms from a place that we call Upper Eden or Upper Gan Eden. Now, when that light begins to flow, that light continues to flow. It does not stop. However, built into us is this system that is kind of like a little bit of a regulator, okay? So when the light comes down, it has a capacity to look at each individual, where they're at, and how much light they have. And then once they have the measure of light that they can contain at that moment, the light turns and it starts to recycle, go back up, and then it will keep feeding you until, you know, you receive all the light. But all of that light is being absorbed by those who are people of honest spirituality, okay? Then when we get Sheba, Sheba means either there's a covenant or an oath, or it means seven, okay? So then when we talk about the seven, we know that we're still talking about the festivals, right? So we know that Maor, Sheba, the luminary, which is, now we're going to bring in the other word, Torah, right? So the luminary of the Torah is going to shine in each one of those festivals. Now, let's take this just one more step farther, because you say that that light is given to us for the seven festivals, but it's not given to us only at that time. It's literally given to us all the time. It is more amplified, let's say, when we go through the mechanical process, the physical process of celebrating the festivals. Because when we celebrate the festivals, what happens is we physically enact spiritual realities. So in other words, those spiritual realities that exist, we physically embrace them and we walk them out, and then we increase the light that comes into us. This Maor, this luminary aspect of the Torah. And so that being said, we're constantly upgraded. And it doesn't matter how fast you try to get away. It's so fast that the moment you try to get away, it drags you back. Even if it's got to grab you by the hair of the head and pull you back into the whole regime of what's going on, right? And, of course, I'm just kidding. But Ezekiel does say that, you know, an angel grabbed him by the lock of the hair and yanked him up into the spiritual world. So you can kind of get the difference between this whole idea here in this message of ideas. Now, one of the other things that happens is we all know that there are two other festivals that are not considered biblical, but they are considered to be rabbinic. But none of us would say that, well, just because I don't see it in the Bible doesn't mean that I'm not going to follow what the rabbis teach us about. And, of course, the first one we'll say is Hanukkah, okay? And so we know we celebrate it for 8 nights, etc. And the reason we do that is because that of the process of making the oil, literally what we call the Nes, the miracle of the oil. But really what's happening is there's an interchange. Today we don't have a menorah that we fill during Hanukkah. We have what is called a Hanukkiah, right? So one has, you know, 9 candles. One is for the shamash, the servant aspect of that picture of Messiah. But then the other is associated with the 8 day where it came into this. But when you compound the 7 times this the 7 days, and you start to come up with these particular numbers, these numbers start to have quantum expressions in the way we feel and live out our life, okay? And so one of the other times, of course, that we know, or now we understand, that the Maor, the luminary of the Torah, doesn't just go to 7, it goes to 9. And so we see that luminary aspect of the Torah coming to all of the differences, or all to the all of the different festivals that we participate in. Now, all of this is something that the sages say, once you connect the Or Haganus with the Maor Shevatorah, then you have to make it temporal. It works inside of time. And of course, there's so many complications to talking about time. And then for all of us in this group, we're saying, you know, we're really being here at this late in 56 or 57, 86, we're saying, you know, man, you know, when is this culmination going to take place? And, you know, the last time I talked about a lot of the gematria of all of that stuff and said, you know, certain things, whether they're true or not. I don't have a drum to pound and say it's going to happen at this particular time. I read this book one time that there was 88 reasons why the Messiah was going to come in 1988. And for some reason, I missed something. I don't know what it was, but either he came and I didn't know about it, or that guy was wrong, or something like that. You know what I'm saying? So that's why I'm not one for trying to really set dates. But, you know, I talked about a lot of dates in that last class. But I think that at least learning about many of those things is very important, and trying to gather some data as to the potential things. And I said a lot of things that perhaps I shouldn't have said, but nevertheless, I said them anyway. And Don Shlomo got mad because he wanted it to be within our time frame and not, I'm just kidding, he knows it. He wanted it to be within our time frame, not sometime in the distant future. And I think everybody here would agree with Don Shlomo. You know, tomorrow wouldn't be a bad day, you know what I mean? If that's really what he wanted to do, then it's all good with me. He can upset my apple cart anytime. Okay. So, in working through all of this, you know, something I don't know how to tell you that it works like this for me, but I wish I could say I've got this direct path of education and information that I'm moving down, and I try to have a sort of systematic process that I'm going in. But, you know, if you're walking through the dark, you know, one of the two things is going to happen. Either you really know the area that you're traveling in and you don't stub your toe on something, or when you're traveling through the dark, you do hit something and you fall on your face because you stubbed your toe on something or whatever it was. The other night, I did a real good job of banging my knee. I thought I was in the right proper lane in the dark in my house, and I needed to be 3 inches this way. And you know how that goes when you're in the dark. It's all good. But nevertheless, I say this because a lot of times as I'm studying, one of the things that happens to me is, as you all well know, I'm very word-oriented. So when I see some word that is either something that is something I don't know about, or it's something I do know about, and I go, wait a minute, how did that creep into this whole line of thought? And so as the material was working out, and as I was studying through this, I kept reading Maor Shevatorah, Maor Shevatorah, Maor Shevatorah, and I kept reading this phrase over and over. And I talked a little bit more about it in last class than I'm going to do in this class, but nevertheless, I kept coming out with this idea that there is some connection to something that we don't really realize that it has that connection to. And we don't have a realization quite of the foundation that was played in the invention of this particular system. Now, what I'm going to tell you first is this. You can't find one thing in the enemy's camp, however you want to say that, that is not a real invention. He's never invented anything. He mimics everything. He does not know how to come up with something original. So, for example, concealment is one of the things that God put in place so that we could have free will. But what the enemy does is he says, okay, if God is going to hide himself so that we can have free will, what I'm going to do is hide him even more. So you can't see him, you can't think about him, and then you won't even think about God and you'll do all these things of negativity, okay? So he takes and tries to veil God even more than what God intends, okay? Now, when you start to look at systems outside of Judaism, many of the systems that we know of, they mimic some sort of aspect of Judaism, okay? So I'm not going to get into a bunch of name calling, but you can start to understand, you know, that there are some aspects. Now, I've taught in the Romans class, I think last week, not yesterday, but the last week, and I basically showed how that when we start to look at the aspect of spirituality, it started, and the New Covenant didn't start in the New Testament era. It started in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. So when you start to read Jeremiah, Jeremiah is prophesying about the things that happened in the book of Ezra and Nehemiah. And then you have to come and you have to learn that when you're reading in Acts chapter 2, everybody's saying, oh, this is the New Covenant, this is the New Covenant. No, it's not the New Covenant. It is the last days. It doesn't say anything about being a new covenant. And in Joel says, you know, look, in the last days, this would happen. So we mean that at that section, the last day started. That was the last 2,000 year period, which is called the days of Messiah. But you understand immediately after that, Judaism was hijacked. And it was hijacked into this system that actually mimics a lot of what Judaism does and the practices that go on. So if it wasn't for Ezra, guess what? There would be no such thing as Christianity. How can I say that with confidence? Because Ezra is the one who, whether the synagogue started before that or not, he made the synagogue be a real aspect of everyday life in Judaism. And guess what else he did? He made the public reading of the Torah 3 times a week. And so when you start to see these implementations, you say, well, where did the church come from? How did the church get involved in all of this? And it's very simple. They mimicked Judaism. And so they didn't call it church anymore. They called it, or the synagogue anymore, they called it church or whatever. Okay? And they called it ecclesia. And they have absolutely no idea what ecclesia is. Okay? The called out ones. It's a term that is used in the Greek Senate. It has nothing to do with spirituality. And so they abuse the language in that, but that's not here nor there. But as I was studying, I stumbled across an idea that, you know, really floored me to begin with. And I kept saying this word Torah. And, you know, you say Torah once, you say Torah twice, you say 3 times. Then you look up to see if the Japanese are coming or what's going on. But I'm just kidding, of course. But when you start saying the word Torah, you start looking around and you say, oh, there's a word here somewhere that even though it's mispronounced and even though it's basically misused, somehow it has to be tied to something Jewish, right? Everybody's got the clue now. Everybody knows what I'm talking about, right? What am I talking about? I'm talking about the tarot cards. Okay? What are they? They're tarot. Okay? Tarot. Okay? So somehow this whole system gets bent and mimics something in Judaism that people have little awareness that it got hijacked out of Judaism. Now, the first thing I'm going to tell you, don't think that I'm putting a plus sign on the tarot cards, okay? And that system of, what do they call it, fortune telling. We'll tell that story in a minute, okay? So that's not what I'm talking about. But I'm talking about how the enemy has taken something and hijacked something spiritual and began to use it for some negativity, okay? So now one of the first things that you should also know is that when you say Torah, we understand that the Torah is the five books of Moses. But we also understand that that word means teaching or instruction, okay? And so teaching instruction of the Torah is Moshe. And so we understand Moshe being the teacher and the instructor of the Torah, okay? But a Torah is a lesson or an instruction, okay? So in Romans chapter 8, it says, the instructions of the Spirit of life keep me from falling into the instructions of the Spirit of death, okay? And so we understand that the instructions of the Torah give us spiritual life, okay? Then if you want to take it on the negativity, what happens is the instructions of the devil lead you to hell, okay? Plain and simple. That's just as simple as it gets. I'm not saying that, you know, that happens to any of us here because, like I said, once you start getting the Torah inside of you, then you start have a swelling and it comes over. But, you know, how did they hijack this whole system? Now, there are a few articles on the web that you can hunt down and look for yourself. But how did the idea of fortune telling with the idea of the tarot cards, how did that get started? Well, you know, I'm not a card player, so I don't have, you know, a lot of experience at Pinochle and a lot of those other games that you play. If you want to play, you know, some card like, you know, war or something like that, I know that the ace is more than that. You know, we're down to things that are a little bit simpler than, you know, the complex card games. And that being said, you know, I know the fundamentals of the cards. Now, when I'm talking about cards, you didn't realize that I was moving back and forth between a regular card playing deck and the tarot cards. You didn't even catch the drift, did you? Okay, but even the cards that we use today are still built on that same basic system of the tarot card. And most people, you know, my dad always used to say, don't play cards, don't play cards, it's the devil. Well, you know, not that I believed him for anything that he said about those things. He just didn't want you to do it because he didn't want to have to buy a pack of cards, you know. He was too tight on his money. But the first tarot card started out with 22. Okay, so everybody understands the implications here, right? Started off the Aleph Bet of the Hebrew language. So the Aleph is 1, the Bet is 2, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so it had what they call these arcane cards. And the arcane cards are, you know, of course, the king, the queen, the jack, blah, 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 and then the ace, okay? Now, when you put this into the tarot system, the ace was what they called the joker or the fool or whatever they call it. And then you had the king and the queen and the jack, etc. And so then what you did was you put those four cards on top of the 10 cards, the other 10 cards. And then you had four particular suits. Everybody knows what I'm saying, right? Okay, you have the spades, the diamonds, the hearts, blah, 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 blah. Where in the world did all of that come into the whole ball game? You know, because it's very interesting. Well, it's interesting that, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I know another system that uses that number. And it's called the Sephirotic tree, okay? So we have 10 things on that tree, and when you have 10 things on that tree, then you put the arcane above them, then you have 14 cards, right? Am I counting right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 14. Yeah, I counted right. Okay, so then you have 14. Then you have 14 times 4, and you come up with what number? 56. Am I right? Everybody looks at me like, let me get my calculator out. Everybody's as bad as me. That's what I got to do. Okay, so the point here is, yes, it's 56. So, you know, when you started to put all this stuff together and you start trying to understand what in the world is going on, what you do is, like I did last week or a week or so ago, I wanted to do gematria, right? And so what was the gematria that I came up with then? And what kind of gematria am I going to come up with tonight, you say? Okay. Okay, so it's interesting that when you, of course, you won't believe me, but when you go to the first book of the Bible and you start to come up with something, you know, the first word of the Bible comes up with the number 56. Okay? And so then 56 is a breakdown of some letters, and it's the word koah, which means power. Okay? And that has a numeric value of 28. But when you start to read the first book of the Bible, you find out that this is only used so many times in the Bible. 56 is only used 56 times in the Bible. And so once you start to find all of these little hidden innuendos in the word and the number 56, which is koach twice, koach, koach, power, power, okay? When you start to understand this, you understand that now what we're talking about is we're talking about some sort of a spiritual system, okay? And so inside of Judaism, I'm not going to tell you that the Jews had some sort of card-playing system where that they did this and that they were able to determine the future. And when they were able to determine the future, that, you know, they could use this system as a fortune-telling card, okay? But there is an idea, and most of us here are pretty aware of Spain and Spain's some of Spain's Sephard practices, and we know that, of course, that in what was it, April or something, or May, March, I guess it was, when Columbus set sail from Spain, and it was in 1492, the same year that all the Jews were expelled from Spain. But some people claimed, some Jews claimed to have converted to Catholicism, and they even proved it because they ate pork and they did these things, attended church, and they did things that Jews don't do. But what they didn't know, what the Christians didn't know, is that they were still secret. They were secret about their observance of the Torah, of the Torah-based system, etc. But they used to use a system where they had flashcards. And the flashcards were first used to teach their children the Hebrew alphabet. Okay? So they had, how many cards did they have? 22 cards. Okay? To teach their children alphabet, the alphabet. And then there is a speculation, and I'm going to leave it at that because there are a couple of articles on the internet that you can hunt down. I looked at one, but I'm not going to recommend anything. If you find something and you prove me wrong, that's okay with me too. It doesn't bother me. I know there's a connection here, and I can continue, and I will, to try to make you see some of the things that I saw. But they started out with this, but then later it is understood that because one of the things that was happening in the world at that time was that spirituality was beginning to really, really come to the forefront. Kabbalah, the Zohar, had just been written, not but a and not even 100 years before that time. And so the Zohar being that spiritual book, people began to study it and try to learn the mystical things. Now, if you got caught practicing any of those things in Spain, you were in serious trouble. And so the whole Spanish Inquisition was associated with much of this idea. But they seem to have possibly, possibly, used this same alphabetic system as some methodological way of teaching the deep spirituality. And that spiritual system is called Otiot. Otiot, and Otiot means the light. It's the plurals of light. And so it's not light, but it's light. And when we say Otiot, we almost always mean the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Okay. And then those 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet are light. Okay. So then when you mix them with Torah, you have the Torah of light. Okay. And then once we start to say the Torah of light, we're talking about things that are deeply, deeply spiritual, okay? And so now the reason I brought 56 into this whole process is because the normal deck of cards, the normal deck of the tarot cards is 56 cards, okay? And so this system originally started with 22 cards. Each card had a particular figure on it that represented some aspect of the Torah alphabet or the Hebrew alphabet, okay? And so the system went from first 22 cards and is finally, as of the 18th, 19th century, it has come to be this 56-card system, to where that they go through this process of, like I said, they use the arcane upper four, then they use the lower 10. And this was supposed to be a system of studying the Sephirot, okay? And they called it Kabbalah. Now, when we say Kabbalah, we're talking about those who have received the tradition that has been handed down by another spiritual mentor to a person who is being taught the Kabbalah, okay? And when we use Kabbalah in Christianity, they came and hijacked Kabbalah. Everybody may not know this, but they did. And when they hijacked it, they changed the letter. So they didn't spell it anymore K-A-B-A-L-L-A. They spelt it C-K-A-B-A-L-A. Excuse me, not A. For my Aleph, okay? And so they hijacked it, and then they just changed how it was spelled so they could differentiate between Kabbalah and Kabbalah, okay? Christian Kabbalah versus Jewish Kabbalah, all right? Then, you know, here comes the occultists, those who practice, you know, the process of divination and many of these negativities, fortune telling, and we'll get into that in a minute. But once they started this process and they started fortune telling, they hijacked Kabbalah, but they spelled it differently too. They used a Q instead of a K. Okay, so let's make sure that nobody knows what we're talking about, even though we're talking about this thing that came out of Judaism. Okay. So all of this stuff gets started to, you know, blend together. And then, you know, of course, all of us can understand, as we did at the very beginning of the class, there is a deep, deep spiritual system that Judaism holds, and it teaches us deep spiritual things about God. And that light flows all of the time. But the enemy doesn't like that. And so what he's always going to try to do is offer a counterfeit. Now, one of the things that happened in the garden was this Nakash, this serpent came along. And I don't care how you define him, whether he's something slithering in the grass or, you know, some say he was in humanoid form and et cetera, et cetera. I don't care how you define that. You define it how you want to and you explain it how you want to. But I'll tell you what did happen is that when he came, he interjected a system that questioned the word of God. Okay? God said, you do this, and you'll be good. If you don't do this, you're going to be punished, okay? Or he literally says that there's a consequence, okay? You eat of the tree, you're going to die. That's consequential. You eat it, and that's what's going to happen. I'm not trying to punish you because you did it. That's the consequence of what's going to go on, okay? You can't tell a young lady who slept with a man and got pregnant that, you know, she's forgiven and everything's okay, but guess what? You're not going to suffer any consequences? Oh, don't tell me that, right? Because we know that it's not true. There will be consequence. She's changed, you know, her whole life because of this process. How she deals with it, that's a whole nother situation, not tonight's discussion, okay? So eventually this game comes down to, it was first started as just a card game. The tarot system was just a card playing game. And then, you know, somebody comes along. Interestingly enough, he's a Catholic, and he has another occupation, and that's a Freemason. Okay, that's a wonderful combination, right? And so he sees the idea of this Kabbalah, this Kabbalistic system, and he notices that there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, and this system is using these 22 cards, and he notices how each one of them is this, but he thinks, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to hijack it, and I'm going to use it for, you know, my own spiritual practices, and voila, you have Christian Kabbalah, C-A-B-A-L-A, okay? So, you know, the whole thing comes about in about the 18th century when they decide the Kabbalah, or excuse me, the tarot cards are not for everyday users. They're for fortune tellers, okay? And the fortune teller who knows how to do it right can tell you your fortune by the way that the cards lay out through the tarot system of practice. I'm not telling you how they do it. I don't know how they do it. I don't want you to get involved in it. But I'm telling you, it's a false system, and I'm showing you where it came from so that you understand the dangers. Okay, way, way, way back in the Roman times, in the Greek times, there was this goddess. She was one of the most beautiful goddesses of all the world. Her name was Fortune. Fortune, okay? And if she was sweet to you, or should I say it like this, if you were sweet to her, you had good fortune. And when you had good fortune, that meant your cornucopia was full. So the cornucopia is associated with fortune, okay? The goddess Fortune, okay? But she had another little toy she liked to play with all the time. Everybody has seen it. You just don't remember that you've seen it or know you've seen it. You've even seen it in contemporary times. It's called the Wheel of Fortune. This was her toy. Now, she used it to tell the future. But it's interesting, there were four letters on that wheel. And when you turned the wheel, you gave it a spin, kind of like the TV show that you've seen recently. Okay, when you gave it a spin, you know, you're looking for no whammy. Oh, no, that's another one, isn't it? That's other game. I'm sorry. And you're trying to get, you know, the highest dollar amount you can get, okay? So as it goes, you know, the Wheel of Fortune, the TV show, is built after the way they used this thing, okay? So the four letters, you didn't get it, four letters? The four arcane letters are Yud, He, and Vav, He, okay? So what you have is you take the wheel that has these four letters on it, and you spin the wheel, just like you see on TV. And if it comes up the Yud, yay, you're a winner. And you're on top. When you're on top, you're the winner. You get the most goods, and you get all the goody, goody, goodies, okay? But you have to be sweet to Fortune. Otherwise, she might, you know, fix the wheel so you get nothing on the top and everything on the bottom. So it's a whole thing where we start to come to the understanding that it's hijacked. It's hijacked in even the name of God to try to bring that power into this negative system. Okay, so she uses this wheel, and with this wheel she can basically more or less reign over you. Now, what happened in the 18th century turns out to be something that is quite elaborate, and that one who really tried to hijack the Kabbalah system and then bring it into this tarot system came from Egypt. Sounds like something that you couldn't make up in a movie, right? So he comes from Egypt. And you know what? How come he comes to believe that this system is a system for fortune telling that should be used only by the fortune tellers? Because at the top of the Wheel of Fortune, there's a Sphinx. So he says, voila! Now I have two of them in my house, two Sphinx in my house. If you ever watch my cats, when they recumberate, they look exactly like a Sphinx. And the biggest boy, he looks more like the Sphinx than the Sphinx looks like the Sphinx. But of course, the Sphinx was supposed to be a liminal creature. Okay, and the liminal meant that he was two worlds mixed into one, and he was part lion or whatever it is, the other half of the Sphinx, and part human. Okay, so when they saw this, if you get blessed, as it were, or if you get fortunate, how fortunate can you be? You understand some of our terminology has been played with over the years as we use it. We just keep using this word. How fortunate I am, etc., right? If you were fortunate, the wheel landed on top where the Sphinx was. Now, you know what the Sphinx was? He was the guardian of the horizon. What does that mean? That means every day you had to go spin the wheel. And when you spin the wheel, if you made fortune happy and you made the Sphinx happy, then they would let you have good fortune for the day. But if you didn't make both of them happy, you what? You were unfortunate. You didn't get any food for the day. Okay, so of course, who would come up with something as ludicrous as bending a spiritual system into a methodology of this entire nonsense? Okay, so once you start to look at the present day cards, don't do it. You can do it if you want, but don't do it. It's not worth your time. Used to be the highest card was a priestess. Supposed to be this beautiful woman. And it's interesting, as soon as I saw the picture, it's like it slapped me in the head and like to knock me out of the chair. Because on one side is Boaz, on the other side is Yachin. Now that may not mean anything to you, but it means everything to me because I studied the construction of the temple. In the pillars going up to the temple, to in the court of the women, one on one side is Yachin, the other is called Boaz. Okay, Boaz is on the strength of God, etc. Yachin is associated with this idea, a little bit of unity, etc. But this priestess is standing in the middle of the two pillars. Not a problem for me. Why? What would you associate it with? Wouldn't you associate the priestess? I know she's supposed to be called a priestess. I know the name's been used as a deflectionary system. It's the Shekinah. It's the glory of God that is standing between the pillars, showing that the glory rests on the temple. So they have this priestess here. Now, this is the most beautiful part. She has a big cross on her chest. And so you know she's been hijacked from the Shekinah into the, don't say that word, church. I didn't mean to say that. Okay, so you see what's happened with this whole idea. And then when you see, there's these two others, this next card, you know, Aleph, Beit is two, right? And then two others. And the two others, they call them the lovers. Immediately I knew who they were. They're standing next to a tree in a beautiful garden with something standing over the top of them trying to influence them. That was good. And the next one has got this symbol, and it is associated with the Gimel. And unless you understand Hebrew alphabet and the meanings of the words, you don't get a clue. Now, I went to Israel in 2011. I've been there several times before that. And when you want to dicker with an Arab, you don't deal in money. Okay. So we had this beautiful young black girl in the congregation with us. Chicken Bauer, Gibber, Gibor, and Adon Suriel, I can tell you. Okay? She's a pretty little girl. We take her down to, we don't go to Bethlehem because it's all Arab territory. So we take her down to this store where these guys, you know, they have a store in Bethlehem, but we don't go there. So they have another store on the other side of, you know, the Palestinian lines, etc. And so they go in there, and then the girls in the process of the coming into the group, and the leader or the owner of the store, he goes, "Who's responsible for this group? Who's in charge of this group?" And so I said, "I am." He goes, "We need to talk some business." I said, "Okay." So what business are you talking about? He said, "How many camels for the girl?" So I went to talk to her for a minute. I said, "Now, sweetheart, I have something that I have to tell you. These guys are going to buy you. They want you for a wife. And they're going to pay 25 camels for you. And so, you know, I hope this has been a good trip for you. It's going to be a little longer than you thought it was going to last. But they're giving me 25 camels." "No, no, 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 no." Everybody knows that a camel is a G, right? A gimel. Okay? And the gimel is what? Prosperity. Okay? So if you have camels, gimels, you have a lot of prosperity. And so the Aleph, Beit, and the gimel has to do with prosperity. So what symbol would you use for prosperity? Easy enough, right? I figured out in a heartbeat. The Wheel of Fortune. You couldn't make this up if you were on LSD. I'm telling you, you can't do it. Okay, so here's how they keep doing this system to where you get there. And then, you know, of course, actually, they kind of contort the last symbol because, of course, the last symbol should be Dalit. In the Dalit, we know everyone here should know the Dalit's a door, right? And so it's supposed to be like a door of spirituality. Well, you know what they use for it? Oh, everybody knows. You just don't know, you know. It's a skeleton. Well, if you're not prosperous, you're certainly not going to survive. So, you know, you're going to end up a skeleton. Okay, so basically, you know, the whole system. And I'll bring my determination to a close. is one of those systems where, you know, nobody knows what it is, but when you really realize what it is, you go, how demonic, how ugly can something possibly be? Well, you take something that God has given as some beautiful, beautiful thing like the Torah, the instruction of righteousness, of holiness, of spirituality, and then you mimic it with some instruction of negativity or death. And then can you imagine how people would feel if there was that wheel of fortune that they had to go and spin the wheel every morning when they got up? And you didn't make that God as happy that day? So, tomorrow morning when you wake up, what are you going to do? We're going to say the Moda Ani or Moda Ani for you girls, right? We're going to say we don't give a rip about the Wheel of Fortune. We got the true thing. We got the real stuff. And so, this is just one of those systems where all of the negativity really shows up in this occultic system. Now, just so you know, that fortune shows up in the fortune teller. Go get your palm red. I always used to think when I was a kid that they painted your hand red, and I didn't really care about that, so I didn't want to go. But go get your fortune red, and then she'll tell you whether you're going to turn up good or bad. But let me tell you something. It's a little secret that you don't know. You've got to give her a little bit more money if you want a good reading, okay? If you don't give her, you know, more money, she'll say, it's bad luck, son. You're done for. So that's the end of my rant. I thought I would expose that after I stumbled over it in trying to study about spirituality and how it got hijacked. Questions or comments? Where can you buy a set of tarot cards?
I have. No. No thanks.
I was going to say I don't know.
Even I don't know if there's a connection or not, but when you mentioned the priestess with the cross, I can't help but think about the Catholic Church and how they deify Mary.
Yeah. Well, that was the whole hijack right there. That's exactly what they did. So I don't know where you can buy tarot cards. And I won't even ask you to go on Amazon and look. So
I was going to say, it's on Amazon, I'm sure. So
this is worse than the history of Christmas.
Yeah. Your Eminence, what does the word Kabbalah mean? And how does that...
Comes from the word kibbal, which means to receive. Okay? But the idea of kibbal isn't just on the deep spiritual stuff. It's from all Jewish tradition. Anything you learn in Judaism is handed down by your rabbi, and you kabbal, you receive it from your rabbi. That's the intended process. God gives it to the rabbi gives it to you. It's not that you can't receive it for yourself. You know you can, okay? But, you know, that's the idea, a whole mechanism. So then when you move into the deep spirituality of a thing, they call it Kabbalah because really the idea is that it's just you and your teacher. You and your teacher study the Kabbalah together. It's not supposed to really, really be studied in mass the way that a lot of it goes on today. And even if you do have several students in a class that you receive Kabbalah, so to speak, or spiritual information, you need to judge their level of capacity before you really say things that are too far beyond what they can really comprehend. Okay, so for a long time, I had a revelation, and in the revelation, I knew that I just couldn't say it. There's no way you could make me say things that God revealed to me, because I believed that until I had a better way to understand what I received, I need to have a better way to explain it. Okay? And if I gave it, without the proper explanation, it could destroy a person. It could literally ruin them. And I'm not playing to be so spiritual that, you know, I just go around with that mentality, because I don't. I generally put people on the same level with me. Come on, let's go study the Torah together. Yeah, I'm going to give you the deepest thing I know, but very seldom do I ever hide. I may hold back for a week or two because I've got other things that I need to say and do to get to that point, but I'm not going to say something that would hurt a person spiritually. Although I think Adon Shlomo is still upset with me from 2 weeks ago when he found out that it was going to happen this year. But he could show me a system where it's next year and it'll be okay with me too. So it's all good. So do you understand what I'm saying? Cabal, receive. You still upset Adon Shlomo? No, he's not upset.
No. I do have one little question.
Okay.
Do you still have any of those camels?
Actually, she didn't go for it, but I kept negotiating, and I got it up to about 50 camels. I'm just kidding. But he really did do this now. And that was the second time I had seen it happen. And it had this, we were in this, we were at dinner one evening, and you know, they do the big buffet type situation. And in that dinner, this guy came up to me. He noticed I had been sitting at this one table. And one of the ladies that always went with us on the trip, she had a daughter who had beautiful blonde hair and pretty girl. And he comes over to me. He goes, hey, can I ask you a question? I said, sure, what is it? He goes, is the mother of that girl in that at that table right there? I said, yeah. See the other lady sitting right next to her? That's her mother. He goes, thank you, sir. So then he goes over to the mother. How many camels you want for your daughter? So I'm looking to take a bunch of girls with me too, because I ran out of camels now at Don Shlomo.
You know, we laugh about that, but you can almost hear that in the negotiation with Eliezer.
Yeah.
Or Rebecca.
Exactly. You're right. You're exactly right. You're exactly right. But now, you know, one of the things we did is we went to Petra. And when we went to Petra, you cross over into Jordan to go to Petra. And you can't you can have your Israeli guide, but your Israeli guide doesn't really do any of these things that are, you know, really super, super oriented to the guiding part. They're just there for basically the group. And so they give you a Jordanian guide. And those Jordanian bus drivers, I'm going to tell you what, they're doing 100 kilometers an hour, which is a little, or right around 60, I guess. And, you know, it's a two-lane road, and they don't care. They pull, someone's coming on the opposite lane, they'll pull out right in the middle. They don't care. They're bigger than everybody else. Get out of the way. But, the bus driver keeps going, yella, yella, which means hurry up. I don't know if he's telling us, hurry up, we're going to die or what, you know. But this guy, his name is interesting. He's sort of like Joseph, you know, in Arab language. And he tells the whole story from the beginning to marriage of the process of courting a woman. And he did incorporate the camel story of the worth of the woman and the camel. So it's pretty ancient, I guess. They sit around and have coffee and talk about how many camels that the girl is going to be worth. So you girls, anytime you really want to go, and don't worry about saving up the money to come back, just get us over there and I'll get you back. Or I got your back. I mean, however that works out. Okay, everybody good? Or anybody got anything else to say? Okay, you guys have a wonderful Shabbat, and don't tank any wooden camels, all right? 'Cause
Shabbat Shalom, everybody.
Shabbat Shalom. Yes,
Shabbat Shalom. Thank you, Your Eminence.
Lila Tov.
Lila Tov.
Thank you.
You're most welcome.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom. Shabbat Shalom.